And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris here with you. It's Wednesday, July 21st, as you can see in that single shot at the very beginning of the video. If you're watching on YouTube, moving is progressing. There are boxes everywhere. There's almost nothing left on my walls. The picture over my shoulder of the old baseball cards from the Burdick collection, that's the only thing left on the walls in the entire apartment, just to add a pop of color to the videos that I'm doing.
And I see you were drinking your cellar, so you don't have to move a bunch of bottles.
It's such a great technique. It's the last thing you really want to do is drink all of your booziest, heaviest beers while trying to pack and like get your life together and trying to like solve problems every day. Like, where am I going to sleep on this day when I'm in between these two cities? And where might I stop?
I know it'll help. 15% stout.
Yes, that'll clear my head for me. But you know what? There was a celebration for me. I am a Milwaukee Bucks fan. I mentioned this in the last episode. I'm a bandwagon Bucks fan. Hardcore back in the day when I was in high school and college. Less so the last couple of years, but Giannis is must-see TV.
Those the Eric Snow years?
Yes. Yeah, like yes. Back around then. Yeah. I mean, the Ray Allen, Glenn Robinson team that got knocked out by the Iverson Sixers, that team broke my heart. And then when they traded Ray Allen for Sam Cassell, that was the end for me. That was when I couldn't bear to watch anymore.
Ah, Glenn Robinson, that's right. I remember those years. It was a interesting game, pretty ugly up front.
Oh, man.
But that sort of played into the Bucks' hands, I think, because in terms of who you could turn to when the defense, when the refs are allowing fouls and the defense is stout, Giannis is up there in sort of Shaqian way that he can get you a bucket. You know, like he can just, you know, back his guy down and turn around, and he had that like 4-foot hook going, and if he has that going, then you've got a beast, and you just got to wait till the other guy's shots start falling, and that's basically what happened, I think.
Yeah, not a lot of answers for Giannis in that series. He was incredible, obviously the Finals MVP, and even if you're not even like a basketball fan all season, that was a fun series to watch. I was hearing that from a lot of people who don't even watch that much basketball. They were really, really enjoying what unfolded. So I was excited, got to watch the game with my wife and my in-laws. They've been helping us pack. So we had a celebratory mug, coffee mug, literally coffee mug full of the Central Waters.
Sorry, the glasses are packed.
The maple bourbon stout, special beer, really good special occasion beer. But I was like, well, it'll taste pretty good out of a mug. You'll smell it really good. And it actually worked out great. So points for being resourceful. On this episode, we will discuss the extension given to Lance Lynn by the White Sox. Brandon Marsh has been promoted by the Angels. We saw Josiah Gray debut for the Dodgers, and we've got a few more questions to get to from the mailbag as well. So let's get to it with Lance Lynn. Details of the extension, 2 years, $38 million with the White Sox, club option for 2024. That would cover his age 35 and 36 seasons, age 37 in 2024, if they end up picking up that option. And I thought we should try a little Lance Lynn trivia, because I have been destroyed by Lance Lynn trivia in the past. There was a game once upon a time called Lance Lynn or Jake Arrieta, and it happened on our podcast Step Right Up, which was a game show podcast we had 2 years ago. So if anyone out there remembers that, drop a note in the comments or hit me with a tweet, because that was like one of the very first podcasts we launched. And unfortunately, we didn't continue that one, even though it was a lot of fun to make it. So Lance Lynn, you know, since 2019... minimum 200 innings for everybody in this group. The group includes 100 more than 100 qualified pitchers. Where does Lance Lynn rank in innings since the start of 2019?
I'm going with first.
He's fifth. So yeah, he's near the top of the leaderboard. 390 innings for Lance Lynn. How about ERA?
Wait, can I do any of the innings ahead of him?
You want to name the guys ahead of him? Sure.
Is Yu Darvish on there?
I got to pull up that leaderboard. Who else do you think is on there? Darvish is one you think is on there.
Not hurt.
Darvish is not. Darvish is 365 and a third, so about 25 Berrios? Less. No, Berrios is close, 378.
Why am I not thinking? I think the not hurt thing is just a weird one. It's like Gossman?
I think...
He just started getting hurt.
This group is pretty much the guy. There's only one guy in this group that I think is a surprise. Of the four ahead of him, only one is a surprise.
Not hurt. It says it's not hurt is not a thing that like stands out in my head. Yeah. And then a lot of the guys where I'm like, oh, Marco Gonzalez, but he was hurt this year. Mm-hmm. Why is this not coming to me? Kyle Gibson?
No. You're overthinking it.
I'm overthinking it?
Yeah. Gerrit Cole's number one.
Oh, duh.
And God, the guy after him is just like the king of the rubber arm. That this guy's going to pitch forever if he wants to. He probably doesn't want to, but he could.
I don't know why.
Greinke.
Oh, yeah, Greinke. Duh. Yeah. God. I'm so bad at trivia. I'm really, really bad at it. All right, so just tell me the rest.
So it's Cole, Greinke, Bauer, and Zach Wheeler are the four that
I was going to say Bauer, but I just felt like maybe this recent thing had knocked him off. And then Wheeler is interesting because he's been hurt. He just hasn't been hurt recently.
Right, he's held it together in the last couple of seasons. So yeah, just to see him on that list. But Lance Lynn, obviously very durable, provides plenty of innings. Where do you think he ranks in ERA? In the same span,
I go with like 10th.
Yeah, very close. 13th, 3.16 ERA during that span. How about WHIP?
Smaller, right? I think, but I'm not looking at this page, so I'm gonna go like 4th,
25th.
25th.
Smaller. I thought you meant the other direction. I thought you meant like a little worse.
No, he doesn't have a good. WHIP.
114. It's not bad. Oh. It's hard to believe they're actually, that's tied for 25th. There's that many guys that have been better than that in WHIP with 200 innings over the last three seasons. A K-minus BB percentage. This one's your sweet spot.
I don't think it's actually elite because there are guys with higher strikeout rates.
I like that you're sleuthing this out.
Huh?
You're sleuthing this out. I like it.
But I think better than WHIP. So I'm going to go like 17th.
Yeah, tied for 21st. I think that'd be a ding, ding, ding. I think that's pretty close. 20.3%. And then finally, strikeout total during this span.
Oh, but that's like basically another innings question. Does he have more strikeouts than Greinke? Yes. So I'm going to give him like 3rd.
9th in strikeouts.
9.
There's some sick strikeout rates out there. So,
because somebody like a Glasnow could pitch fewer innings but have like 15 K per 9.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. But it gives you an idea, right? I mean, 5th in innings, 13th in ERA, 9th in strikeouts, 25th in WHIP, and even 21st in K minus B percentage. Lance Lynn is a better pitcher than we thought he was when he went to Texas a few years ago. The question I have for you is, how has he done it? What has changed about him? On the wrong side of 30, no less, how has he made adjustments and reinvented himself to become a guy that would get a multi-year extension before his deal runs out at this stage of his career?
Well, it's really interesting. I was just talking to Alex Fast from Pitcher List about pitching development. He's got a couple pieces coming out about that, about team-by-team looks at pitching development. And, you know, the Rangers may not have done a good job producing pitchers. Right? Like, in terms of, like, homegrown pitchers, we're looking back to like Derek Holland and Alexi Ogando as the last time they kind of developed in-house like starting pitching. And yet at the same time, they've been pretty good at taking veterans. So I think their major league pitching coaching has been okay because they took some veterans like Kyle Gibson and Lance Lynn and made them better. And at the All-Star game, Lance Lynn said that Texas just had him basically go for more strikeouts by throwing the four seam more than the sinker, and that the Cardinals have been all about the sinker. I had a piece about the adjustments that made the All-Stars, and it's pretty remarkable. If you graph his sinker usage against his K percentage, they're inverted. So that was a very clear relationship. But then I asked him, how many fastballs do you have, dude? because normally people think there's only like sort of three fastballs, maybe four, and I think you have at least four. And he's like, yeah, you know, I've got the a two-seam, a true sinker, a four-seam, and a cut. And then he said, and the Greinke does this too, I have a nice and easy one. So he has some sort of batting practice fastball that he throws. And so then I was like, well, doesn't that put a lot of pressure on your command? Because if you're just throwing fastballs out there, you're not changing the speeds that much. So it seems like you really have to place those pitches. And he said something that was very interesting to me that I haven't studied enough of, and it's been interesting to me in the background. He said, yeah, but if they know a fastball is coming, they're in swing mode. Hmm. And it's something that Adam Ottavino once said, like, you know, when I first came up, everyone said, oh, you got to be aggressive against Adam Ottavino because you don't want him to get to the counts where he can just put that slider on the outside corner or past the outside corner. So you got to be aggressive. You got to swing up there. You got to try and get the fastball. And he said that Ottavino used that to his advantage. But then Ottavino said that one year he had some trouble with command early on, and the mode changed, and the batters came to the plate saying, I got to make him throw a strike. I'm going to wait for a strike. And that was the really bad year that Ottavino had. So, you know, swing rate matters, and it's not something that we talk about a lot in pitching. And, you know, when I look at the major league leaderboards this year for swing rate, I think it's kind of telling. Number one is Cole Irvin on the Athletics, who does not have great stuff numbers, but he does have good command numbers and has a bunch of pitches. And next is Tyler Anderson of Pittsburgh, which is, you know, somewhat similar. On that list also is Urias and Manaea, Wheeler, Kershaw, Jordan Montgomery, Kyle Hendricks, and of course Lance Lynn. Nola and Scherzer are on there too. I would describe all those guys as having great command. So sort of the top 25, I would say more than half have upper level command. And so I think that's what command can do for you, is get the batters in swing mode. And so therefore you can get them to reach more. All these guys have above average reach rates. And that means they're swinging at balls and turning them into strikes, which is huge for a pitcher. But it just also means that you're getting the hitter to be aggressive, and you can turn that to your advantage. Because there are guys like Rodon and Giolito on here too, who are not big command guys, but I don't know, throw their fastballs enough in the zone, somehow have gotten batters into swing mode. So I just think that was a funny, a little interesting side thing. And Lynn and I had a fun back and forth about pitching and what it takes. And he's basically saying, if you got him in swing mode and your fastballs all move a little bit differently at the end, you could really take advantage of that.
Did you get to talk to anybody else like at length about pitching while you're at the All-Star game? And it's such a good opportunity to get to speak to so many players all at once if you catch the right people in the right spots.
Yeah, it's funny because for the most part, I was asking him my one question and piecing out, and you kind of are at these like media tables where local media kind of with the sharp elbows you out of the way, especially the radio and TV. They have these like boom mics, and you'll just be sitting there waiting patiently, and all of a sudden there's like a boom mic that goes right by your face, and then an anchor who's standing next to them being like, hello, you know, is it okay if I just ask a couple questions? No, actually, I've been sitting here for 5 minutes. Like, please get out of my face and let me ask this question. The two that I had, I wouldn't say like super lengthy. Sometimes you can write a piece off of 5 minutes with a person. That's a sort of dirty little insider secret. I had that sort of spark with was Lynn, where I just got a couple moments with him alone. I think he appreciated the fastball question, and the swing mode thing was really interesting, and we kind of had a back and forth where he was kind of smiling and like, it was something maybe different than he'd been asked about, like Shohei Ohtani and how good the White Sox will be like a million times. And then the other one was Brandon Woodruff, who I don't think I'd ever spoken to before. So I didn't know what to expect. And so when I asked him about his major adjustment, he talked about, you know, throwing weighted balls and how that helped him not necessarily change his max velocity, because he said at Mississippi State he was able to touch the same velocities that he touches now. But he said that it was better at changing his sitting velocity, which I think is sort of a misunderstood thing about weighted balls. I don't think they're great. Like, if you throw 93 now, especially as an adult, if you throw 90, maybe as a younger person you can develop max velo. But if you're sort of an adult and you max out at 94, weighted balls will help you sit 92, 93 instead of 89. They won't necessarily change your max velo. Not for most people. So he said he could sit. He could sit now. He can sit at 94, 95, and 96 because of the weighted balls. But this is something. So I've heard that weighted balls change your arm path, and it's because in the back, if you've got the ball, it's heavier, then your body is just going to organize differently, because it's like, oh, this is heavier. Like, I'm not going to do this big old, you know, roundhouse thing in the back. You know, big old swingy arm path, because that's like a strain on my arm. I'm just going to pick this ball up and throw it because it's heavy. And so that shorter arm path, I've heard people complain about it around baseball. Oh, that's the driveline arm path. You know, the Giolito, the Indians, the Plesac, and all those guys. That's the driveline arm path. I don't know. I don't think it causes injury or anything. I don't think that every player needs to have the same arm path in the back. I don't know that it has the same benefits for everybody. But Woodruff said it had this interesting side benefit of making his breaking ball better. Mm. And he had this thing where he said he was a changeup pitcher coming out of Mississippi State. And that he was always better at sort of being behind, like sort of being like when you land, like being a little bit later, his arm coming through a little bit later. Because if you're breaking balls, you kind of want to release out in front. You kind of want to, like when you're releasing the ball, you kind of want to stand. You want to be released out in front. But change-ups, it's okay to be later on because you're kind of coming through like this. You're kind of pronating. So he said that by cleaning up his arm path in the back, he was able to throw better sliders, because he was then with the same delivery able to get out in front quicker with his arm, because he was spending less time in the back with his arm. And so he said his slider got a lot better with the weighted balls, which is not something that happens for everyone, but it happened for him with his unique mechanics. Interestingly, all of his pitches rate as above average by Stuff Plus, but his slider now rates as his very best pitch. So we had this sort of, this is a weird word, giggling interaction, where we kept passing it off to each other about rotational energy and about timing and about what you want, where you want your hand to be at footfall and where you want to release breaking balls and changeups. And I was at the end of it, I was like, dude, I gotta go talk to other people. I would rather just stay here with you for a while, but I gotta go talk to other people. So Woodruff is now high up on my favorite pitchers list.
Nice. Well, hey.
Always was.
Yeah, you had him pretty high before, so yeah. Curious to see how high he goes.
To, I guess.
Well, that's really cool. And I think the weighted ball, I guess cleaning up mechanics just in general, it does make a lot of sense, because if you have to control all of your body to not hurt your arm, you're going to work on being more stable, being more balanced, maybe having a better core. And all of those things are going to probably become more consistent over time. And then you take the weight away, and of course, you still can repeat those mechanics more easily, because it's like a muscle memory sort of thing. You're training in a way that gets you into that sequence and gets you out of some bad patterns. So a really interesting benefit there that, yeah, like maybe the main reason you do it is you think, oh, I'm just going to throw harder. Well, why do you throw harder? Well, it's because your mechanics are better and more consistent, and the command is more consistent too. That might be the hidden benefit of the weighted balls for some people. They might just think, I'm gonna get a couple ticks. Like, well, yeah, I'm also going to get better command. That's a trade worth making.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I have had someone push back on that. A neuroscientist that worked with a major league team came up to me after a panel at Sabre Analytics and said that the neural pathways that you use to organize, to throw and command a larger object are different than the ones that you use to command a lighter or smaller object, which makes sense. If I asked you to try and throw a boulder at a certain thing, you would be using completely different muscles, and, you know, just to put it at the exaggerated level, than if I asked you to throw a dart. You know, it's just completely different in terms of muscles, but also apparently in terms of neural pathways. So it sounds plausible, but I would say that that's on the extremes. And I'd be a little bit surprised if the neural pathways for throwing like a 6-ounce ball versus a 4-ounce ball were really that different.
They shouldn't be that different.
Like, they're the same shape too. It's not like a dart versus a boulder either. It's like, these are both balls.
There are two people that live in my home. One of them studies the brain, and I am not that person, so perhaps I will consult.
Ask her if she thinks it's plausible.
Consult Mrs. Van Riper on this one, because this is absolutely her wheelhouse and certainly not mine. Let's get to Brandon Marsh. He has been promoted by the Angels, and Marsh is a pretty interesting player because I think there's been developing power. I think it's one of those things that scouts have pointed to for a while, that they expect him to get to more game power than he's probably shown us at just about every minor league stop so far. A true center fielder, like a guy that will stick in center field for a long time. He runs well. He's got a pretty good arm. So, you know, he's going to be defensively playing because he's going to play because of his defense for a long time. How good he is as a hitter.
I remember seeing him out in left. My God, is he shaggy. Really reminded me of Jason Worth out there in just terms of all that hair.
Yeah, that's it's good to have a few more guys like that out there.
Oh, he was in center field. Interesting.
Three in a row in center. They got Taylor Ward out there. Did Taylor Ward grow a beard?
No, I think he must have just made a catch in left field when I was watching or something.
Covering left field for Taylor Ward. So Marsh is interesting because I think there's at least a great playing time floor because of the defense. As a hitter, he's been good pretty much everywhere he's played. He's been at least an average hitter at every single stop, and he's flashed being an above-average player. He's stolen some bases. The projections point to a 240, 312, 384 player the rest of the season. That's according to the BatX. Like that almost seems a little too low, even though I think there are some concerns about Marsh's strikeout rate in the short term.
Yeah, I guess reaching back into sort of 2017 to 2019, he didn't really show exemplary power. And he hit a lot of ground balls. And even this year in AAA, he hit a fair amount of ground balls. So I guess there is some question about his attack angle and what sort of power he'll produce, which is why BatX is the happiest and most optimistic about his power, giving him 144 ISO. Everyone else is below that. But I don't know. We saw him play. What year is that? 2019?
I think it was 2019 fall.
AFL?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was pretty impressed with his athleticism, and he's a big guy. So I think it'd be weird for him to have league average power. He's also had some better results this year in terms of power, 213 ISO in AAA. That was his first time with the sort of major league ball in AAA. So it could be that the ball helps him produce a little bit more offense at the major league level. In any case, I think the power projections are low. And it's possible that the strikeout projections are high, because if you look at his swinging strike numbers, they've never been high. He's actually been very good at making contact. I would assume, looking at his walk rates, that some of his strikeout rates have come from patience. So if he's more aggressive on the major league level, you could see a smaller strikeout rate. And he certainly hasn't hit the ground with a ton of strikeouts. So if the power is low and the strikeouts are high, I think we're looking at a guy who could be more likely to hit 250 or 260 with like a 330 on base percentage. Definitely a slugging percentage over 400 for me. Type of guy who in a full season could maybe do 2015, 2010 in terms of 20 homers and 10 stolen bases at least. I think that's definitely in him.
Yeah, I just think maybe we get some bumps along the way in the second half from this particular profile. They waiting it out too long against big league pitchers will be even more costly than being perhaps too patient in the minors. But again, a nice player all around, a guy that certainly fits for them. No Joe Adele yet, and Adele has pushed his overall numbers at AAA to the point where he's got a 112 WRC+. The K rate is under 30%. So that's an improvement from his first stop at the level back in 2019. Gives you a glimmer of hope that when he comes up, that maybe he can keep his K rate kind of in the low 30% range.
Adele has 19 homers and 7 stolen bases. Call him up, man. But just in comparison, Adele has had swing strike rates almost twice as high as Brandon Marsh at every level. So I don't anticipate anything better than a 30% strikeout rate for Adele when he comes up.
Yeah, and I think the other takeaway with Brandon Marsh for me, Eno, is that it just seems kind of like the scouting community, the people who can analyze minor leaguers with their eyes and kind of project on that, like they seem to be generally pretty high on him and what he's going to be able to do as all the pieces come together. Whereas when you number scout him, you kind of like Frankenstein and everything together and it looks pretty good. But I think the projection from a lot of scouts would be better than what you'd get if you were just projecting them purely off those numbers.
Yeah. 6'4", man, I thought he really struck me as bigger than that. But, with the taller guys, that was the thing with Jason Wirth, was a little bit of a late blooming because kind of getting his limbs in the right place at the right time to tap into that power. Which he didn't have great power numbers in the minor leagues and reduced the strikeout rate. I don't know if I'm crazy on this Wirth comparison. I don't even know if they... Wirth was a lefty, right? No, Wirth was a righty. But I could see a similar career, actually, to Jason Wirth. But Jason Wirth took a little bit to get going. Didn't really have a full season until 2009 when he was already 30. So if he is Jason Wirthian and he gets going earlier, then that could be a really good career because Wirth had 229 homers and 132 stolen bases and was 20% better than the average with the stick over his career. So really underrated guy.
Yeah, well, I think with Wirth, people got a little wrapped up in the big contract and him maybe not performing at the end of that, but you could be a good player before, you could be a good player at the beginning and still be a good player overall, even if you don't meet elevated expectations.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, we had some more debuts. We have a career debut and a season debut to break down. Let's start with Josiah Gray. The results overall weren't great in terms of the ratios, but Gray did I think show an ability to miss some bats, 7 Ks in 4 innings, pitching behind an opener, scattered 4 runs on 4 hits, only walked 1. I think the question for a lot of people out there, if they haven't already emailed it in, is how good was the stuff and command from Josiah Gray in his first attempt to deal with big league hitters?
Very good. Very good. There's always a chance for regression. Shane McClanahan and Alec Manoah have had they debuted with better stuff, amazing stuff, and then regressed off of that. But with this, I at least see a four-seam fastball that has a 101 stuff plus 106 if you compare it to other four-seam fastballs. So I would say even if that regresses, that should be at least be an average four-seam fastball. And then curveball and slider combination that were both comfortably above average. Even better, the location plus on all three of those pitches was outstanding. And when I was watching him, I thought he did a really good job of living at the top of the zone with the four-seam fastball. And not sort of, if you watch Dylan Cease, you'll see living at the top of the zone with the four-seam fastball. But that also means like sometimes 2 feet above the top of the zone or whatever. Like it's very scattershot up there. Gray was just dotting the upper edge of the K-zone box. So there was enough there. I don't get command plus numbers that quickly. They usually have to run through them a day or two after. But I would assume that Gray showed a great command plus because, it was pretty impressive to watch his four seam command at the top of the zone. If you've got that and you start dropping the breaking balls in off of that, that can be really effective. So I would say, that I'm like all thumbs up. I guess the only question for me is, what happens in that Dodgers rotation around the deadline? You've got Bueller, Urias, and Kershaw are in for sure. Gonsolin and Price probably have to prove that they should remain in.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Gonsolin, he hasn't been as crisp as he was previously coming off the shoulder injury. So there are some questions about how effective he's going to be trying to get deep into starts. I think he's gone 5 innings just one time this season. A lot of 3s and 4s in that game log right now. And David Price, they're just starting to increase his pitch count now. It's kind of like they need at least one of those guys plus Gray currently just to keep things afloat because of the Kershaw injury. Obviously, Bauer's on administrative leave amidst sexual assault allegations. So who knows what's going on there.
If I was running the Dodgers right now, I would combine Gonsolin and Gray, I think, because... Or I guess just figure it out with the two of the three. Have it so that Gonsolin's day shows up Gonsolin pitches either the Price day or the Gray day, which means it's awkward to do this, but not be an opener, be right. A follower. And have Gray and Price start those days, and then Gonsolin jumps in when the game is close, but you don't like what you see, or Price just can't go past the third yet, or Gray has loaded the bases, but you're still winning, that sort of deal. Then you bring Gonsolin in. But I think Gonsolin is kind of a major win from Command Plus, because even when he was doing so well in those first two attempts at the league, Command Plus said he had reliever-like command. And I think we're seeing that was definitely the case in the postseason last year, and it's definitely the case right now. So I think long-term he may be a reliever, which means either use him as that sort of mid-inning follower with lots of innings type guy, or put him in a trade for a starter. I think you would rather hold on to Gray and trade Gonsolin. And I think Gonsolin's probably going to be valued fairly well by other teams who could kind of ride some bumps when it comes to making him a starter.
I would agree with that. And I think they could try and get a more established rental option for the rotation.
And if it costs you somebody that you think is a reliever in the future anyway, then maybe it's worth it. So I would say either way, though, Gray is, I would consider him kind of a sixth starter going forward in terms of innings. So I don't know if I'd go super hard on acquiring him if I'm not sure how many innings he's going to give me.
Yeah, we've seen this pattern from the Dodgers before, and I think he's that extra guy right now who could be shuttled back and forth between the rotation and bullpen for a lot of factors that are quite simply out of his control.
And as options, so he can go down and remain a starter. I think he'll kind of remain a starter. The question is, will he do it in the big leagues or the little leagues? It's not the little leagues.
The little leagues.
The minor leagues.
Sorry. Yeah, the little leagues. That's probably not going to be the new name of the minor leagues in the long run. There were a couple of questions about Touki Toussaint and his season debut. Of course, he's been up and down for parts of three seasons now with Atlanta, but he pitched really well against the Padres, at least in terms of the results. 6 2/3 innings of a one-run ball, 5 Ks, 2 walks, 3 hits, picked up the win on Tuesday. And I think the thing that was most surprising is that, you know, the last couple starts he'd made at AAA were also good 6-inning starts as well. This is a guy who's struggled with control really at every turn as a big leaguer. He's had some problems keeping the ball in the ballpark, but not the most extreme home run rate overall when you look at the total body of work, just particularly bad in the shortened season with 7 homers in 24 1/3 innings. So just curious if you got a look at some of the underlying numbers with Touki Toussaint yet.
Guess which of his pitches Stuff Plus likes the most.
I already looked it up, so I'm not gonna look like a genius for knowing.
Well, I was surprised. It is the split finger.
I wouldn't have guessed that prior to seeing
145 Stuff Plus on the split finger, which is something that he sort of has taken on later in his career. He's always was more of a curveball fastball guy, looking for that second, third pitch type thing. And so that makes me more hopeful about his future, because between the split finger and the curveball, he's got two pitches that are at least 20% better than league average by stuff. And the other thing that makes me hopeful is his command plus last year was 96, which is a vast improvement over the sort of 83s and 84s and 85s he put up in previous seasons. So those are the good things.
And now for the concerns.
His sinker has a 76 stuff plus and his four seam has a 66 stuff plus. They don't get a whole lot better when you just compare them to sinkers and four seams anyway. So, you know, if he kind of concentrated on the sinker, which has an 85 stuff plus compared to other sinkers, maybe he could make it work. But his location plus, which is not quite command plus, but it's like, you know, what locations does he throw them to, are also below average on those fastballs. So I think, and I just don't think he has good enough command on the curveball, and nobody other than Kevin Gausman has good enough command on the split finger to kind of use that to get called strikes. So I think he ran into an aggressive Padres team, which is, we kind of go back to that swing rate idea. You get an aggressive team, and then your command looks like good enough and you look great for that night. And then you run into a patient team that just makes you look awful. And I'm not betting hardcore on Touki. I love him as a person, though. He's such a nice person. And, you know, he's one of those guys who calls you sir in the interview and stuff. And just a really nice person. And I'm rooting for him. And if he does do it, he's going to outstuff his command problems. But there are some command and fastball issues there.
Yeah, it seems like he'd have to throw that splitter a lot more than he did on Tuesday if he's going to exceed expectations. So are we drawing the line at maybe 15 teamers with good matchups, being kind of careful with him in those formats and mostly focusing on him in NL-only leagues and maybe in some deep dynasty leagues as a possible stash for the future?
I would like to see something here real quick. I'm looking at team batting stance just to sort of check my math here on where the Padres are in terms of swing percentage. Well, they are last in the big leagues. Oh, God. How are you going to be careful with him, dude? How are you going to be careful with him? What's his next matchup, most likely?
Yeah, that's kind of a key here. He should go, if I don't have an off day on Thursday, I'll pull up the grid here. It looks like he goes Sunday at Philly. So we'll get to see him again before Fab runs in a lot of leagues. And then next week, home against the Brewers would be his matchup.
Because at Phillies, I would not want to start him.
Yeah.
And then you say home against the Brewers. You know, Atlanta is one of the most hitting friendly parts in the big league. So home against the Brewers. Brewers have not been scoring a lot. What are the Brewers in terms of play discipline? They are also very patient. If he does fine against the Phillies in Philadelphia, I would increase my Fab because then I think I might start him against Milwaukee at home.
All right, so you got to see something good Sunday to be a little more aggressive, but otherwise playing a little safe with Tukey. And I think one of the questions that came in about Tukey, there was more than one, pointed to the scouting grades on his Fangraphs page, right? 60 grade fastball, 65 grade curveball, 55 changeup with a future 60 grade, and then a 50, 55 cutter. I mean, that's four average or better pitches if well, the scouting grades come up. But
right now.
Right, so he's lost
one. What was the
one.
Command grade?
40-45.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. So I think that points more toward long-term reliever than successful starter.
I had a piece. Man, I got to find this. But I'll try to find the piece while I'm talking about it. But there was a piece that was shared, I think, by Razball going back. And I'm going to try and find it, but he was talking about it was a football thing, but the idea was that floor, like, we should be drafting for ceiling, and it was more nuanced than that, but the idea was that at least once you pass a few rounds, it's very obvious that because the replacement level is higher in fantasy leagues, almost every single fantasy league, than in real baseball, you should be drafting for ceiling, because if they don't hit the ceiling, then you're going to replace them with waiver wire. You know, and maybe this is more true in football, but I think it's true in baseball too. And I think it kind of reminds me of that conversation we were having about pitching, like, how do you spot future aces? And I don't want to seem like we were being wishy-washy about that and like saying it could be anything. But that's the point about drafting for ceiling, is that if they do anything at elite level, then that it's like that max exit velo thing, right? If they do anything as a pitcher at an elite level, that describes their possible opportunities, right? So if Cole Irvin has the same command plus as Ryu, which he does, you know, then he could be Hyunjin Ryu.
Right.
Now, in terms of projected outcomes and what's most likely, it's most likely that Cole Irvin is not Hyunjin Ryu, right?
Like, correct.
And we've anointed other players, future Hyunjin Ryus in the past, and it hasn't worked out and whatever. But the point is, if the acquisition cost is low, and that's what probably, I think Cole Irvin won't even cost that much next year, because people will be like, I don't believe it, or at least I don't believe it on that level. Then there becomes a point where he becomes worthwhile just in case he hits that. Now, of course, that math is a little bit different if it's an AL only, blah, 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 blah. But in any case, these two things kind of mesh for me, where I'm like, you know what? If you're talking about spending a buck on Tukey and putting him on your bench, then I'm all for it, because the possible outcomes for him are pretty good. You know, that there is stuff here. There's stuff to like, you know, there are elite pitches in his arsenal. On some, I don't think, if you're talking about spending $20 in FAB on Tukey, then I'm out, because I think in some, these flaws will get to him.
Right. It's more likely that the flaws hold him back than the ceiling is reached because of the things he does really well, based on the balance of what happens. But there's enough that he does well there are circumstances where it makes sense to take that chance. Like, he is not absent upside, to use a word that I don't use very often. He actually has it. There is projectable growth in that profile that you can get excited about, especially in deeper leagues. I don't think he's, if you're in a 10-team keeper or dynasty league, or a keep 7, keep 8, keep 10 sort of league, long-term appeal in Tukey is minimal right now, right? But a deep dynasty, you talk about Devil's Rejects all the time, right? That's a 24-team league. It's huge.
Yeah, I wish I'd picked him up in that. I would love to have him on the bench right now. I have Thomas Hatch on my bench. I mean, you know, one of these guys is going to... I just have a varied... I just also wanted to point out that I have a varied approach to picking up sleepers because, you know, Thomas Hatch and Tukey Toussaint are not the same thing. But, you know, you don't want to do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, plenty of ways to get there, which is why we tried to outline a few different paths on that episode on Monday.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Let's get to a few of the questions that came in for today's episode. First email came from Adam. He writes, Brandon Lau is a fun player, 152 WRC plus against righties and a 36 WRC plus at the time of this email against lefties in 2021. 3-4 war players that hit 200 are a special breed. Lau's splits, maybe want to look at Jesse Winker's splits, 180-50, by the way. And these questions also apply to him to an extent. Number one, when do splits against righties and lefties stabilize? Lau is all over the place against lefties through his career. It is up and down year over year. Where should we expect him to end up? Are pitchers doing something differently this year that's leading to the 40% strikeout rate against lefties? We'll start with this question first. We've seen this from Lau before. I think it was 2 years ago, 2019, the K rate was just through the roof high against lefties, and he looked like he was only going to play against righties, and that was going to significantly cut into his playing time, especially on a Rays team that is so good at mixing and matching and having platoons put together.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you just basically want to follow what the team is doing because that'll tell you more than trying to kind of regress these platoon splits. But, you know, here it is. According to the book, we regressed lefties' platoon skills against 1,000 plate appearances against LHP of league average splits and 2,200 plate appearances against righties at 2,200 plate appearances against lefties. That means when hitters have less than 1,000 or 2,200 plate appearances against lefties, we estimate their platoon skill to be closer to league average than their observed platoon performance. So basically, for a lefty facing a lefty, you need 1,000 plate appearances, and for a righty facing a lefty, you need 2,200.
It's like they never really become relevant. But that's the conclusion we've come to in the past, right? It's like you never.
That's the thing that Derek Carty says. There is no such thing as a lefty crusher.
Right. Yeah. Like James McCann and I think Kike Hernandez are some guys, especially if you're in the DFS Twitter space at all, and you're loading up those lefty mashers, you're not actually getting the advantage that you think you're getting based on the numbers, but about that seems incomplete to me.
Here's what's incomplete about it. They're regressing against league average. Righties do better against lefties in league average. So there is such a thing as a lefty crusher. It's just all righties. You know what I mean? Like, until you have 2,200 plate appearances, it's hard to say that, like, this guy, like Kike, he kills lefties. I don't even think he has 2,200 plate appearances against lefties.
Well, no, and I think then you start to run into the same problem that we've talked about in other types of matchups or splits, is the players change over time. You're not the same player for the first half of that sample as you were for the second half. Like everything could be totally different.
Let me see here. Even adding up, that's why it takes so much, because you're adding up plate appearances over a player's career. Enrique Hernandez has 1,000 plate appearances against lefties. And so what we're saying here is he's gotten observed 120 WRC plus against lefties and 84 against righties. That's a huge split. We're saying that even though we have 1,000 plate appearances, you got to take another 1,000 plate appearances of league average and put it on top of that to estimate his true split. So since he's about halfway through that, we can actually kind of do this math a little bit in our head. Let's see here. This is a piece I'm reading from Matt Clausen, estimating hitter platoon skill on Fangraphs. And so the average wOBA split, let's see here if we have a righty. The average wOBA split is 6.1% of a difference. And his is 40. Is that right? Actually, it's supposed to be wOBA. So 349 versus 294. His is 100. So you would take 50% of 100 in wOBA difference, or 50% of a 40, let's do the 6% because that still makes sense. So you got a 36 observed, you take 50% of that, and you take 50% of 6%, which is the league average, and you hit them together, that's 42 divided by 1, 21. So you're expected, you would expect the split between his lefty and righty production to be 21% rather than nearly 40% that it is now. Was that some easy enough math? I'm sorry if I broke anybody's brain, but you would expect basically Enrique Hernandez to do well against lefties, but also to do about half as well against lefties as he has going forward, until you get that sort of even more information going forward. So there are lefty mashers. They are right-handed hitters. And that's something that Derek Carty says all the time. So there is some nuance to it. Like, yes, right-handers do better against lefties. And so if you are a DFS player and you do use righties against lefties more often, then that's a good plan. It's just not, you know, it's not that Enrique Hernandez probably has like this immense skill beyond that.
Right. And then the problem would be that in a tournament scenario, if everyone believes that Enrique Hernandez, or a large portion of the field believes Enrique Hernandez has that skill, and therefore he is more heavily utilized, more heavily rostered, you don't necessarily want to use him, depending on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to get leverage in DFS, then that matters. And if we're talking about season-long daily moves leagues too, you're not getting as much of a lift from him as you probably think you are, but you're still getting enough of a lift where it makes sense to use him in spots like that. There's a related question. Can you quantify the value an everyday player like Ozzie Albies versus a player like Lau, whose weekly output fluctuates with the handedness of opposing starters? Do the numbers say to start Lau against 6 righties or Ozzie Albies against 6 random pitchers in a given week? How often does a team generally face 6 righties in a week per season, and where would I be able to find that out? Working backwards, I don't know if anyone's tracking schedules week over week split by handedness like that. Kind of seems like a thing someone maybe could do. Is someone doing it? Who's doing it?
Razzball.
They're doing it? That's awesome.
Yeah, they have a pretty cool tool that I've been using this year called the Streaminator. And it's usually used, I think, by people to look at pitchers, because they'll project a pitcher's performance based on their schedule in the upcoming week. And that's a really good way to sort of look at, this sort of icky two-start pitcher or this better one-start pitcher, which is exactly the same question, right? Mm-hmm. And they also have a hitter version where they kind of look, it goes through the schedule and it looks at handedness and it looks at how many games they have and what you would project. So, and what's useful about this, and I'm only sort of speaking in tones like this about it because it's a pay thing. You got to pay for it. But the thing that's cool about it is that's the way to do it. It's just the way to do it because all the stuff I'm talking about is going to be hard for you to do in your head. Like, because let's talk about Brandon Lau, right? Like, okay, so Brandon Lau has an observed 40% WRC plus split between righties and lefties, right? Well, you'd have to regress that, you know, because he only has 270 career plate appearances against lefties. Yeah. And so you'd have to do a bunch of math there to get him to that kind of that 1,000 plate appearance level. So you have to do, okay, one times this split versus the stuff I just did, right? Mm-hmm. And you'd have to do that for all the players on your roster where you're like, okay, all right, so Lau is probably six times a 115 WRC plus, and then once he gets that one lefty, so he's really probably like a 108 WRC plus, and we got this other guy. So it's just a lot better if you like set up a system that does all that for you.
Weekly projections regression. Are your friends.
Yeah. So it's definitely a tool that I can get behind that I've been using and has been really useful for NFBC this year. You know, if I disagree, at least it helps group. It's almost like, you know, when you look at wins above replacement, okay, you can tell me that you don't believe this guy's wins above replacement. That's fine. At least it's probably somewhere close. Like, let's say you just don't believe this guy's a 3-win player and he's more of a 2-win player and he's at like 2.8. Okay. All right. So you group him with the 2-win guys, right? When you're looking, when someone projects it and it says, okay, this pitcher is in the top 50 and this pitcher is at 150, then I can stop my brain from being like, but I really like the 150 guy. You know? But if the weekly streaming error says, oh, these guys are both top 75 guys, then I can say, all right, now I'm going to use my gut or my personal stats or whatever I'm looking at to then parse it further and be like, okay, I'm going to put this guy over that guy because even though the streaming error says 175 and 171, like, you know, at least it grouped it for me and now I can make decisions on top of that.
Just thinking about this Lau versus Albies thing though, because that's a possible thing in a shallow league. You could definitely run into a problem like that. Like, how would you decide between them, or how would you determine who's more valuable going into the week with their respective matchups? Like, how do you, if you don't have access to those tools, do you look at the matchups and say, in the upcoming week, for example, or this week, I think it's two lefties that the Rays have in seven games, right? Is that enough to sit Lau down? 5 out of 7 matchups against righties in a week versus if Albies plays the same number of games and, you know, the handedness varies. It doesn't matter as much. He switch hits. So I guess he's a kind of a variable guy, but how do you weigh that?
Well, the one thing that's a little different about Albies is that he's got a platoon split that's bigger than you'd expect from a switch hitter. And he's discussed his problems against righties in the past. His power is much lower. His swing mechanics are a little different. He's got this, and I don't actually know how to regress platoon hitters, platoon splits. I mean, switch hitters, platoon splits. But he's got an observed 150 WRC plus against lefties and 96 against righties. So I think if it was the case where both of these guys were facing 5 righties, I might take Lau.
Yeah, it's even trickier because of Albies splits themselves, though, too. So great question, and one that I think a lot of us are too comfortable just looking at the schedule, eyeballing it, counting the games, and just kind of pushing ahead when there is a way to be more data-driven with that decision-making. And I think the benefits are something that Eno's already talked about, but I think people that use information to their advantage in this situation are getting a leg up that a lot of people in leagues simply are not getting.
I kind of prefer daily leagues for this because on the daily league, then you just choose, you only have a little bit of math to do, right? You're just, you're looking at how this player will do against that player, and then it's a little bit easier because you can be like, oh, Winker's facing a lefty today, and I've got this guy on my bench facing a righty, you know, I'm going to switch this out. But on a weekly level, you have to do that 7 times in one go. The only problem is with daily leagues, you have to do the work every day.
Piles up. If you start playing in 10 leagues, it ends up being quite a bit of shuffling around. But I do think if I played in fewer leagues, if I only played in one league, I might actually prefer a daily league for all these reasons. One more question to get to, and thank you for that question, by the way, Adam. This one comes from Mark. Mark writes, I'm in a 12-team Dynasty League that allows owners to keep 25 players a year, not counting minor league slots, and you can keep them forever. I'm in the middle of a competitive window where my team should be one of the best for at least the next couple of seasons, and I have a lot of depth, more quality players than I could keep for next year. My question is this. In this scenario, would you hold all of these quality players as insurance for your team to be better able to endure injuries, or trade away some of the better first guy off the bench kinds of players to maximize their value before losing them in the off season? Thanks, Mark. What do you think here? This is tricky because in a 12-team dynasty league, my argument would be that replacement level on the wire is still a little bit higher, even with all those players held over from year to year. The wire's not completely in a complete wasteland. So you can probably find guys who are playing in a league like that. And if you can find guys who are playing to replace guys you lose, ideally you can trade some of that unkeepable depth now while you still have some leverage. The closer you get to the deadline, the later in the season it gets, the more the other teams in your league know, well, Mark's got too many keepers. There's no way he's keeping all these guys, so I'm not going to give him anything good. So I do think consolidating while you can is a good strategy. Upgrading some of your active spots with some of that depth definitely works in a league of this size.
You said it was a 12-teamer?
12-teamer, yep.
Yeah, I've got a 12-team dynasty situation where I picked up Joey Votto and Willy Adames off the wire this year, and they're now starting for me. And that's because of myriad injuries. So I think that the replacement level is pretty high. I mean, if you can get Votto and Adames-type players off the wire, then I think you're covered in terms of injury, and I would definitely try to consolidate. The only thing I would say is that everybody in these leagues is trying to consolidate, and everybody's coming at you with the 2 and 3 for 1s, and it really annoys almost everybody to get a 2 and 3 for 1. So I would say at the very least, make it a 2 or 3 for 3 where you're showing them who they would drop and where the upgrades would be. And if that doesn't work, if they still see you coming a mile away, or if they just don't want to let you consolidate, then consider trading for picks.
Yeah, that could work for sure.
Trade for picks, trade for prospects, trade for things that you can keep, because when they're sitting on your bench, they're not giving you value really.
Just to put this into context, I mean, some of the final hitters that Mark is referring to, Mike Yastrzemski, Jeff McNeil, CJ Krohn, Joey Wendell, I mean, for the most part, those are guys that in a 12-team keep 25 scenario, they're all going to be kept other than maybe Wendell. For pitchers, Sonny Gray, Adbert Alzolay, those guys are keepers too.
And in this case, what I would do with the specific names is keep Wendell, because Wendell is a one-man replacement level. I mean, he has like 4 or 5 different positions he can play at. It might be tempting to keep McNeil, and maybe that's the case, but somebody might want to buy low on McNeil. And you don't really want to play him through whatever troubles he's got. Plus, he's old, he has a bad reach rate, and he may not have the bounce back level that people are expecting from him. So I would trade McNeil and Krohn to somebody. Yaz, as a lefty hitter that sometimes plays in Colorado and plays on the road, I think would be a fine bench pairing with Joey Wendell. If you had those two on your bench afterwards, you'd be covered for all of your positions. I think Wendell is a shortstop in most leagues. So you'd be covered for almost all your positions with two guys, and then you'd have another roster spot or two to go play with on the wire, which I love in those leagues. So anytime I can pull something like that, I would. So I think a Krohn McNeil package to someone lower for picks or for just a win now piece, for a reliever, for a starter that makes sure you win this year, I think that would be fine.
I would say in a deeper league, the deeper you go, the more likely I would be to hold more of that depth, just because the replacement level becomes
worse.
So difficult, right? You're not finding quality on the wire. But in this situation, especially, which I think is a more common dynasty league situation, try to make those moves. Hopefully that helps some people out there. And good luck, Mark, if you're able to find some deals that actually work for you. Before we go, just a heads up, you can get a subscription to The Athletic for just $3.99 a month at theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels. Gets you all the stuff that Eno writes, everything that I write, all of the fantasy football stuff too. If you happen to play fantasy football, the draft kit just launched last week, so lots of good stuff rolling out in there. And of course, all the coverage heading into the MLB trade deadline 1 week from Friday. On Twitter, he's at Eno Saris. I'm at Derek Van Riper. You can always drop us a line, ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com. That is going to do it for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We are back with you on Friday.
Thanks for listening.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.